This is episode 59 of Kyperion Commentary, and on this episode we're actually beginning a new featured interview, which we're calling Kyperion Life, and the goal here is to provide a more in-depth conversation with someone whom we believe has lived the Kyperion premise of applying the gospel to lower areas of life. This first interview is with Pastor Mickey Schneider, and you'll notice from the beginning to end a certain rawness and transparency that's very rare in pastoral ministry, which is why I have such an admiration for this man who has helped me in so many ways in my young pastoral life. We hope you enjoy this interview with Reverend Mickey Schneider. Welcome to Kyperion Commentary. I'm your host, Yuri Brito. And on this episode, I have the special privilege of having one of my dearest mentors with me here. And I'm here in Valparaiso at Trinity Presbyterian Church with Reverend Mickey Schneider. Mickey, how are you this morning?
Doing great. Appreciate your interviewing me today with all of the illustrious interviews you've done with the past. that you would include me. I'm thankful for that.
Oh, my pleasure, brother. And we've just finished a wonderful and fruitful prayer meeting together, so we're ready to have a wonderful conversation about Mickey's life and history and his pastoral passion over the many years of his service. Mickey, I want to begin by just asking you, where are you at now in your pastoral ministry? Because I know pastoral ministry never truly ends. What's your stage at this point of life?
Well, I retired in 2012 on my 70th birthday, and as you know, and you spoke at my retirement, became pastor emeritus of Trinity Presbyterian Church. I had begun a countdown at the age of 60. I told the congregation and the officers that I would retire at the age of 70 so they could begin to think about, a new pastor for the next 26 years, since I'd been here 26 years, would be here 26 years in. And so we counted down each year. I would tell them, now we've got 9 more years, 8 more, 7, all the way down. And they didn't take it seriously until we got down to 60, to 70, and then we began. So we are retired, and I've had 2 interim ministries in Mississippi and Louisiana, and now we're retired, living on beautiful Lake Sharon.
Yes,
it's a good time in
sure.
our lives.
Yeah. It's a good stage of life. A lot of time to reflect on a long and fruitful ministry. I've been wanting to do these interviews for some time, and I wanted to begin with you because I love your story. I love the art of storytelling that you have really mastered. But I want to do these interviews because it's an opportunity to do this biographical outline of someone's life, which at times is not only punctuated by happy things, but punctuated by pain and suffering sometimes. And I think this is the case, especially for those in pastoral ministry who live this life that sometimes is unknown to many people. And I wanted to just give you an opportunity to talk about that. But I want to begin at the beginning, at the genesis here. Where were you born, Mickey?
I was born in New Orleans in 1942, and I think I've told you before that when I was born in the Garden District of New Orleans, my parents lived in the house that was next door to the house where Jefferson Davis died 55 years before that.
Wow.
So that was give you an idea of my Southern heritage. And my dad was a pastor in New Orleans, and much of what I'll say will be a reflection on my dad's ministry and then the ministry that I've had following him.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about your father, because you are truly, you're the son of a prophet. You are the son of a minister of the gospel. Who was your father? What did he do in life, and how did he influence your steps?
Yeah. Well, my name is Arthur Michael Schneider III, and my dad was Arthur Michael Schneider Jr.
Uh-huh.
And he was a pastor in New Orleans. He just when I was born, he had just graduated, I guess 5 years before I was born, from Louisville Presbyterian Seminary in Kentucky.
The old USA?
The old, this was PCUS, Southern Presbyterian
right.
Church, so that was a lot of my heritage was Southern Presbyterianism, and many good things and many difficult things mm-hmm. there, from that background. And my dad was a I would call an extreme moderate. Mm-hmm. the thing that I have appreciated and received from my dad especially is he was in the New Orleans Presbytery of the PCUS, Presbyterian Church in the U.S., and the Southern Presbyterian Church. And he was the head of the what was called then the colored work in New Orleans. So I was born into a family that was very much against racial discrimination and against segregation. And even though I was born in New Orleans, next door to the house where Jefferson Davis died, and in many ways a Southern partisan, that was one area that I really inherited from my dad. And then later he became the pastor of a small town in Mississippi and was a kind of anti-segregation, anti-discrimination minister. So that New Orleans made a great deal of difference in my dad's ministry and in my ministry as well. New Orleans, of course, a very international, perhaps most international city in the U.S. and it, and in after the war between the states, New Orleans was the third largest city, I believe, in the United States before the war, and of course it was decimated by the Civil War. And the New Orleans was basically a Roman Catholic city, and it was basically an African American city. So all of that played a great deal of had a great deal of influence on my dad and on me and his ministry.
There's a great mystique, if you'll phrase it that way, of children who grew up in pastors' homes. I read a book recently by John Piper's son, Barnabas, I think, where he talked about the experiences, and they were not all flowery. Some of them were very difficult. What was it like growing up in a pastor's home?
Well, that's a real good question, and it was a very formative experience in being in the pastor's home. I would call my dad an extreme moderate theologically. And so in many ways, I patterned my ministry contrary to my dad's ministry. And he was not someone who was very confrontive, and a lot of things that I just did not respect him because he did not confront very difficult things. Even his preaching against racism was very different from what came to be mine, because he took a very low key. He would not preach a sermon on it, but he would allude to it or use an illustration and come at it coming from a kind of sideways position. But and when I later on and became ordained in the 1960s, I just confronted it directly. Every church that I've served, I have preached a sermon on what the Bible says about race, and taking a text, of course, but preaching textually. But I would preach, I would come to it directly, and every church that sought to call me as a pastor, I immediately got that settled with them, that they would not deny anybody the privilege of worshiping because of their race. So, and later, my dad got me a job in our hometown in Mississippi, where I grew up, working for an editor of a newspaper who won the Pulitzer Prize for editorial writing in 1963 because of his editorials on the integration of Ole Miss by James Meredith. And so I did work for a newspaper editor who was very much an anti-segregation.
So growing up in a pastor's home and a father who was moderate in his theological views, you've obviously taken a different perspective on the prophetic ministry of preaching, because I've known you for 10, 11 years now, and you've always been very forthright, very full of conviction about pastoral ministry. Was there a part of your formative years that kind of gave you this level of conviction and forthrightness when it came to the Bible that probably wasn't as clear in your father?
Yeah, I think so. I think my father was not, he was known as a very great pastor, and he was known for his hospital visitation and his love of people and concern, and I learned that in a positive way from him. He was not a great preacher, and in my preaching, I determined that I would be much more forthright and direct, and there, of course, are many different styles of preaching and many different styles of preachers, and my plan was to preach through the whole Bible during my lifetime, and I would encourage younger pastors to do the same thing, to plan to preach and teach throughout the whole Bible. In the days when I was a young minister in Mississippi, I preached long sermons, mm-hmm. and in those days, the pastor was called preacher. So I was Preacher Snyder, and there was down the street was Preacher Jones, you know, and the people were very much in central Mississippi, which was kind of a very conservative thing, and the PCA, Presbyterian Church in America, began to a large extent in central Mississippi. People would actually boast about how long their pastor preached and how long their pastors preached through the book of Romans, how long the series was, and now we have a very different view of preaching. It's seen more as a part of the worship service itself, and the whole worship service is seen as a sermon, and the gospel comes through the service as well as through the sermon. And so I've had to learn a lot about the length of sermons and about the length of series. For instance, I preached at one time, even here in Florida, I preached through the book of Genesis for 4 years on Sunday morning, and I learned a lot, and I think the congregation learned a lot, but I would never do that again. I would, you know, and I should say something, maybe we'll later on, about the church calendar and how I have in recent years, the last 9 years of my ministry here in Florida, I preached through the church calendar 3 times. And that was a very good experience, and I would encourage a young pastor to preach through the church calendar to begin with, and maybe adapt it some. But you know, I have not preached now for a while, so I'm kind of retired from preaching, and I often have the desire to get up and preach. Of course, haven't preached since your 10th anniversary ministry in Pensacola. So it's been 4 months. This has been the longest period of time in 50 years in the ministry that I have not preached a sermon. So 4 months would be...
How does it feel to not have preached for that long, for someone who has done this consistently for several decades?
Well, I miss it greatly, and I have really... My ministry has really been more of a preaching ministry than a pastoral ministry. I've always asked the question, should the pastor be called preacher or pastor? And the preacher in Mississippi was called Preacher Snyder, and now I'm much more comfortable with Pastor Snyder. And I think the word pastor is a term that is almost like a first name, and even children can refer to me as a pastor. And I appreciate the people who have called me pastor, that as if that were my name, because that's what I am to them.
Yeah, there doesn't seem to be a respect for kind of ecclesiastical titles. I remember growing up in northeastern Brazil, that was very clear. This is a pastor or even reverend. Yeah. Why do you think that that lack of enthusiasm for honoring ecclesiastical titles is sort of absent in our culture?
Well, I think it's a reflection of the whole egalitarianism in our culture. And I really had that early in my ministry. I had that that same concept. I really encourage people to call me by my first name, Mickey, my nickname. And even after they graduate from high school, I mean, the young people, I would always called me Pastor Snyder, which I think is an appropriate thing. But I did not, in the early years, I did not wear clerical garb because I felt like I wanted to be look like everybody else and have everybody think of me as just a friend rather than anybody that was in a position of authority. So that's something I've had to learn over the years is the respect and the authority that a pastor should have. And there's a balance there between, being authoritarian and lording it over the people, which we don't want to do, and at the same time that I'm a friend to them to be their pastor.
Yeah, the pastoral calling to be an under-shepherd of the great shepherd is unique because Jesus is altogether transcendent and he's altogether lovely, sympathizing with our weakness.
Christ is our model for being a pastor. And yes. He was a shepherd.
He was. He truly was. And it's this aspect, I think, of what I have observed in your pastoral ministry in the years that I've known you that I think has been most striking is that the little child, the teenager, the young adult, and the elderly folk all share this level of respect and a certain kind of biblical reverence for somebody who's been in the ministry as you have, and they have loved you, and they love you. I don't want you to boast in your accomplishments here, but how do you gain that kind of respect from a congregation that, in our circles at least, varies a lot? We have a generally a younger population because we have a lot of kids. What kind of things did you do early on that kind of brought together different groups of people and their appreciation for your pastoral ministry?
Well, I think it's basically from living among them, and I think that shows the need for the visitation in the home by the pastor and the regular rounds that he makes and the life that he lives before them to have that balance between respect for authority and respect for him personally. But at the other end, maybe it comes from their seeing him lead in worship and his preaching. He establishes that in a formal way, maybe through the preaching of the word. But they don't. I think that there's a danger of their just seeing him on the Lord's Day preaching from the pulpit and maybe having a wrong admiration and respect for, and putting him in too high a position. So I think that's established basically by his relationship with the people over the years. My dad was known as a pastor. That was really his. And sometimes he would even be in the danger of neglecting his family because he was among the people. And the church can easily become a kind of a mistress and the pastor's wife often comes to see the church as a rival for her. And I remember growing up on many occasions, hearing my mother say to my father, "You have time for everybody but us," that is me and the children. And I was determined that would never be the case with me. And yet it was not very long in my marriage that I heard my wife say the same thing to me, "You have time for everybody but us." And so it begins with their seeing you as a husband and father, and seeing his authority in the home, his authority, and his loving leadership of his wife is one of the ways that he establishes that. And I have seen that in you, and I have, I have cautioned you in the early years to be very, very careful that you not neglect your family.
Yes. When you see the kind of celebrity world that is so evident even inside the church today about ministers who really are more focused on the bestsellers and the crowds, and what comes to your mind? What's your first reaction to what you see in our day, which is really a kind of celebrity culture model of church life?
Yeah, that really is very sad to me, and it's a situation that puts a lot of pressure on the local pastor to try to be that kind of hero and celebrity. And when you see how the Apostle Paul was concerned when he wrote the churches for the fact that they had these visiting people who would be, such celebrities, and he had to say to the people, be imitators of me as I also am an imitator of Christ. And so they needed to see in Paul, and then they need to see in pastors today, that humility, the humility that Christ showed in becoming a servant. So the great requirement is to be to balance between being a servant of Christ, and a servant of the people, and at the same time having the authority that Christ bestows upon his ministers.
You, when I think of you, there are lots of things that come to mind, but you have a kind of love affair with history, and you are sort of a self-taught historian when it comes to Southern Presbyterian history, mainly because you were a protagonist in some of that history, especially those important moments. There are lots of things I want to ask you about, but there are lectures done at the Auburn Avenue Presbyterian Pastors Conference in the year 2000, mm-hmm. and they were famously titled the Forrest Gump Lectures. And it appears that you have been in very, very unique places, in very unique opportunities, and you met some very unique people, big players in the history of the Reformed world. I was wondering if you could just touch on maybe a few examples of that history and places where you had the privilege of being in crucial moments in Presbyterian history.
Well, the actual title of that series at the Monroe Pastors Conference in the year 2000 was The History of the Reformed Faith in the South from 19...
It's not as enticing, is it?
No. In the years 1950 to the year 2000, so it was in 2000, looking back on the last 50 years. And I compared myself to Forrest Gump, I'm afraid those lectures became known as the Forrest Gump lectures, and I became known as the Forrest Gump of Southern Presbyterianism. But what I was trying to say was, even though I have not had any great accomplishments, I was privileged to be present for some of the crucial turning points of Southern Presbyterian history in the last 50 years, particularly in the 1960s and 1970s and 80s. And saw many of the important events in God's providence as men struggle for the theological soul of the South, particularly in the founding of the Presbyterian Church in America, where I was on the organizing committee, and saw the beginnings of Reformed Theological Seminary in Jackson, and later the Communion of Reformed and Evangelical Churches. So I see myself as a kind of observer. Of course, Forrest Gump did make some great accomplishments. I mean, he was All-American under Bear Bryant at Alabama, and he was the world ping pong champion, and the Medal of Honor in Vietnam, and he reported the Watergate break-in, and even invented the smiley face. So he was quite an accomplished man, but he was basically known as someone who happened to be in the position of observing things happen. And that's how I see myself. I had a background in journalism and reporting, and I've always been aware of the significant things that were going on around me. I've always kept records and calendars and bulletins that had almost everything in them. And so I often thought that I have lived a very interesting life, and I wonder sometimes, does everybody think that they've lived an interesting life? I know some people think they've lived a very boring life, but my life has been a kind of slice of history of a bygone era, and it's an era that's not that, people don't know much about it and don't really care much about it. So I'm not sure how much my reporting of it is helpful sometimes. I want to say that I really appreciate your interest in these things, because you are someone who wants to know what happened back in the older days. And I greatly appreciate your articles like My Debt to Christian Reconstructionism, because that shows that you do want to see where things were and maybe where we got off track or where things were much better. And I think that's a very, very good thing and I hope that maybe I can contribute a little bit to that, to say, even though nobody seems to be interested in these things, yet there are some good lessons to be learned from the past. And those who do not learn from history are condemned to repeat it. And the main thing we learn from history is that we don't learn from history. So very important.
Well, I think history has, is created out of millions of these little slices. You never know when sometime in history people want to revisit that slice.
I wonder about the value. Sometime I wonder about the value of my experience. My friend Burke Shade told me once, Southern Presbyterianism is just a blip on the scene of church history. And my response to Burke was, maybe so, but it's the blip in which I was born and raised.
Right.
And I don't see much interest in the origin of the PCA, particularly in the CREC, the Communion of Reformed Evangelical Churches, where both you and I are pastors. There's not much interest in the origin of the PCA or the interest of the Southern Presbyterianism in the past. I guess at one time, I was guilty of seeing a pure line of Christianity that came through the Reformation and then through perhaps Scottish Presbyterianism and the Puritans, and then seeing Southern Presbyterianism as being the height of church history.
Yeah.
And I still see that as all those as very important lines, but
right.
I have much more ecumenical spirit
right.
now, you know.
Yeah, yeah. I was thinking through some of the things that I've learned from you over the years about pastoral ministry. One of them being, of course, a love for history, a love for where we came from.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's very crucial. But you also had the unique opportunity to be in pastoral positions where you pastored some very unique and significant figures that have affected not only Southern Presbyterian history, but also really the Reform history as we know it now has affected not only theologically. You have pastored, from my recollection, you have pastored men like Greg Bahnsen, I think Gary DeMar, David Chilton, is that correct?
Right, right.
Can you tell me what it felt like to, and let's not forget James B. Jordan.
Yeah, yeah.
How does it feel like to pastor these great theological minds as a minister of the gospel? What do you have to do to pastor these sometimes big personalities?
Well, I think I have learned a lot through doing that, and I think that what I have come to learn now is maybe more humility. A lot of that was in my pastorate at St. Paul Presbyterian Church in Jackson, Mississippi, from 1975 to 1986. And that was one of the more significant periods as far as recent church history is concerned. But that at the same time was one of the most difficult and controversial periods in my life. The pastorate there was characterized by a large attendance and membership by students and faculty at Reformed Theological Seminary in Jackson. At the height of that period, there were about 50 students and their families that were there. And I have to say, and you mentioned some of the professors and students who came to St. Paul Church during that period. One was Dan Morris, who was professor of Hebrew at Reformed Seminary, now a bishop in the Reformed Episcopal Church. Greg Bahnsen was professor of ethics and apologetics at RTS. John R. DeWitt, professor of theology and homiletics. Paul Koistra taught Sunday school there, who was a professor of Christian education, and then became later on the president of Covenant Seminary and the head of the Mission to the World in the Presbyterian Church in America. And the students at the same time were, as you mentioned, Jim Jordan, also Derek Thomas, who is Sinclair Ferguson's successor in Columbia, South Carolina. Dave Chilton, Steve Wilkins was a student there at the same time. Gary DeMar, Mark Lowry, who was one of the founders of Reform University Ministries. And also at that time, there were a series of debates on the campus of Millsaps College in Jackson, which was a very liberal Methodist college, and I was a graduate of Belhaven, which is a very conservative Presbyterian college, and we had in our congregation there the head of the state president of Moral Majority, which was a very politically active group, and in these debates they would always come to this man who was the head of Moral Majority and ask him to come down and debate. And he would always say, well, I'll send my pastor down. And so I had debates on the campus of the college on humanism, homosexuality, abortion, all those issues that were there at that time. So, having that kind of person in the congregation, I would say honestly that I was caught up in that. And it became, I think, a time of pride to me, and I had to be humble by God to think I would. I look out on the morning. I came to Jackson at a time when there was a deficit of maybe expository preaching in Jackson. There were about 15 or so churches that became PCA churches, and so the seminary students looking for a place to go, and I became the kind of the pastor of the preacher of the hour, and my church was seen by the seminary students as a kind of ideal church. They did not know, of course, the ordinary ongoing activities of the church and how there were great controversies, and I think I fell into the trap of preaching sermons that would be acceptable to seminary professors and seminary students, and I believe that God used me at that period to influence some lives of people that went out into the pastoral ministry. But at the same time, I came to be much humbled by it because it was I did not at that time. I have to say, in all honesty, did not minister to the ordinary folk as I should, and it became very controversial that the seminary students were there in such predominance, and it was the hardest time in my life, and I think it was the time it was the biggest struggle in our marriage because I was on the committee with of the PCA, and I was leaving the I was in meetings in Atlanta and Philadelphia, and I was on the board of Great Commission Publications, and I was on the many ad interim committees of the General Assembly, preached at the General Assembly, and I would say, looking back on it, one of our elders always talks about the golden years, the golden era at St. Paul, but to me were very hard and difficult years and years of struggle, and I did have the privilege of influence and still have contact with many of those people, and they had as much influence on me as I had on them. So there were pluses and minuses, in that being in that position.
Mickey, somewhat of a counseling-related question. During this time when you went through these various sort of controversies and the difficulties involved in just regular church life, as a pastor, Was there anybody that you said, here's the friend I can go to and share my frustration and my angst? Because I think that's probably the pain of the modern pastorate, is that the pastors are, first and foremost, very alone. They have few friends, if any. Mm-hmm. They are, historically, the data reveals that they are, by and large, depressed, probably the most depressed out of all American professions. Mm-hmm. And they tend to be overweight, and they have a very low, their life expectancy is not as high as most other professions. Mm-hmm. So in light of that, during that time, do you recall having, without going into details, but do you recall having somebody to go to?
Well, one of the most influential people in my life was Norman Harper, who was a professor at Belhaven. And he taught a course in the Christian family, and it was a course that was loved by all the students, and one of the students developed it into a book, at least an informally published book and a class syllabus. And he became a personal friend over the years. And then he later taught at Reformed Seminary in Jackson. And when I came back as a pastor there, and so I did, I was at a meeting just a couple of years ago at Montreat, North Carolina, with the with some friends from seminary. It was interesting that my college roommate was there, who had become the moderator of the PCA and taught at Covenant College and Belhaven College, and the executive assistant to one of the executive assistants to Billy Graham, and then the executive assistant to D. James Kennedy. And all of it, I was a low man on the totem pole in that reunion that we had. Someone asked me who was most influential in my life, and I mentioned Norman Harper. And then we went, and I asked them, now, who would you say? And every one of them said Norman Harper was the most influential on my life. And so, you know, there was one man who died maybe 10 years ago with Alzheimer's, and was very influential. And that was a time when actually my wife and I went to him for counseling when we were having difficulty during that period of time in Jackson when, you know, it was this swirling theological controversies going on continually. When I left the church in Jackson to come to Florida and be the organizing pastor here, I listed for the elders 32 controversies that we'd had in 12 years there. And 11 of those were what I would have called church splitting controversy. The level of church splitting controversy would split the average church.
Out of 32.
Out of 32, 11 of those were very major. A lot of those, some of those were my own fault. Mm-hmm. And at that time, I had a wrong view of liturgical calendar, and particularly of Christmas. And I took the Puritan view of Christmas and did not preach incarnation during the, you know, December, and that was very controversial, but a lot of those were just personality differences between members and disciplinary actions. And during that period I actually had to go to the presbytery and defend. We had appeals from disciplinary actions, and I had to go and defend those before the presbytery. So there's this swirl of controversy and upheaval. When people looking at the church, particularly the seminary student looking at the church, saw that as kind of an ideal church, not knowing that at the same time there were great upheavals, and the pastor perhaps was very depressed during that time. And even though I was on committees of the denomination and looked like a, you know, doing you know, traveling for those things, it was just it was a hard and difficult time. Mm. I'm not sure I answered you.
No, you did. I was wondering mainly about people that you could confide in, and, you know, people that you could talk to during your time with the
I think Norman Harper would be the one that I did go to, both in college and seminary and in the pastorate.
I'm concerned about the modern pastor and his lack of connection outside of his own home. And of course we need our wives, and they are in both of our cases. Without them we would not be in the ministry.
Absolutely.
But we need friends, especially other pastors who understand the day-to-day frustrations and joys of pastoral ministry. Let me transition here to a couple of things that lessons perhaps that you would pass on. How many years have you been in the ministry?
Well, I was ordained in 1966, and then when I retired, I've been in the ministry for 50 years. When I look back over the 50 years of ordination, I have had four pastorates in South Carolina, Louisiana, Mississippi, and Florida, and each one of those pastorates doubled in length. So the first was 3 years, then 6 years, then 12 years, and then 26 years. I stayed on an extra 2 years in my last pastorate. And then I had two interim supply pastors after I retired in 2012, one in Mississippi and one in Alabama. And so in 50 years in the ministry, including my candidacy for the ministry, I have been a member of 11 presbyteries in five denominations. I organized three of those presbyteries and became the moderator or presiding minister of four presbyteries. And I have worked closely with 35 ruling elders in four local churches and two interim supply pastors.
Wow.
So but this varied hodgepodge of ecclesiastical background is very far from ideal. Mm. I mean, I would not present that as an ideal by any means. And my work in these presbyteries and denominations is not because of any significant leadership ability, but because of the poor condition of Reformed churches in these years and the need of the hour. It often seemed to me that there was no one to take the initiative. But I have learned a lot from this hodgepodge of ecclesiology about what to do and what not to do. And I've mentioned to you over the years several times that I feel like Thomas Edison, who said about one of his inventions, at least I know 10,000 ways it won't work. And sometimes I feel like that's actually what I have to offer to younger pastors is 10,000 ways it won't work.
One important lesson I think that comes out of that statement you just made is that when there was nobody, you rose to the occasion and took those positions, which are not, perhaps, they're not glamorous.
Yeah.
And you took them because you have a great love for the church.
Yeah.
And a love for the order and decency of it. And so I think that's a great lesson to begin with. But over the years, you have talked about things you have learned from the pastorate, and this is, I think, is very important for younger guys considering the ministry. And I have a particular passion. This is perhaps not something I am proud of, but a particular passion to discourage young men to go into the ministry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because James says not everyone should be a teacher, and I think there is too much of a sense that the pastoral ministry is this glamorous and mm-hmm. sexy and prestigious sort of job. But very early on, you learn these lessons and you realize that perhaps your job was better blogging or talking mm-hmm. theology in a pub with a friend. Mm-hmm. And so the pastoral ministry is a very unique calling.
Yeah.
Let's walk through, I know you thought through this, through a couple of lessons, a few lessons that you have learned over the years that you would encourage a younger Mickey or a young man in seminary or considering going to the ministry. Where would you begin?
Well, I think I would be, I had mentioned to you earlier that I have been influenced by particular articles that I've read that have made a great impression on me, and one of those articles was called Pies, Docks, and Kipes, and then Jim Jordan wrote another article. That began with Nicholas Wolderstorff, who is the Christian Reform Minister, wrote in the Reform Journal in 1975. And then Robert Metcalf, a friend of mine who was a ruling elder during the early days of the Presbyterian Church in America, wrote Pies, Docks, and Kipes in the Presbyterian Journal. And then Jim Jordan, in 1982, wrote an article called Pies, Docks, Kipes, and Lits. And these were the four emphases of the Reformed world, and different groups that emphasize these groups. And so, you know, where I would begin with is with pies, which meant piety, personal piety. And that's where I would begin with younger men to say, the first thing I would say is guard your personal walk with God. Mm. And your personal walk with God is going to be the essential thing. And I honestly wonder today if we have much emphasis in the communion of Reformed and evangelical churches on this personal piety. Sometimes we think of ourselves as more scholarly, more structured liturgically, and all these things. But I think there seems to be a lack of emphasis upon your personal walk with God, the devotional life, being in the Word and prayer, journaling. I think George Grant has emphasized this with his students, that you journal, and I have tried to do that over the years. In fact, one of the the things that has helped me most personally in regard to devotional life has been writing prayers from every chapter of the Bible. So I, over a 30-year period, I have written in not just one, but usually two or three prayers from every chapter of the Bible. And to write a prayer, to turn a passage of Scripture into a prayer, we prayed a couple of them this morning. In the prayer breakfast. Evaluation of a passage, you have to understand what that passage means. And so this is sort of, in a way, a commentary, writing a commentary on every chapter of the Bible. I thought there was no such book like that, and I was going to even consider the several of the elders have encouraged me to consider the publishing that. But my wife went on Amazon.com and found that there is a book like that written by a pastor, a PCA pastor in New Hampshire, who tried to conduct daily worship. I'm sure his crowd must have been very small, but he would take one chapter of the Bible, went through the whole Bible, and preached or taught on every chapter of the Bible. So he wrote a prayer on every chapter of the Bible. I'm just in the process of going through that and seeing and evaluating that. To write prayers and journal like that is a very good practice. And also, to me, the Lord's Day has been one of the basic means of sanctification. And I know that that's very controversial in the CREC today. And I really appreciate an article you've written recently on the danger of letting sports and the sports and the family interfere with the worship on the Lord's Day. And I think that is a very, very important thing to see.
I would say, Mickey, it seems that sometimes there's a confusion with pietism. When we talk about piety, we're talking about the habits, the formation of who we are into conformity to Jesus. I think I've seen this so much in your own life, in the way, even in the way you pray, how your prayers are always saturated with the Bible, which is very indicative of a life spent around the Bible. I think that's, in many ways, a wonderful synopsis of your life, someone who's been saturated by the Bible.
I think in God, in my retirement, God has forced me into a ministry of prayer. I wanted to spend a lot of time reading and writing, and particularly I wanted to study history. I wanted to go back and read on the war between the states in American history, and to see church history, to get better acquainted with church history, and then to study worship, and which I've come to, you know, many changes through the years of thinking about worship. But our pastor here, Ben Rozell, has asked me to take the prayer breakfast again, which I have done for over 30 years, and I still have much to learn about prayer. So as you experienced this morning, we have a group of men that have met in this prayer. I'm the only one who is still there from the beginning, but that prayer breakfast has been going on for probably 35 years. Wow. And we've learned much about prayer. So
it's a profound experience too. I mean, we're kneeling together as men for 30 minutes. That's not something you see happen much in the evangelical landscape.
Yeah.
So pies, that'll be personal piety.
Yeah.
What other encouragement?
Well, before we move away from personal piety, I would put in there, guard your marriage and family life.
Yes.
You know, as I have urged you to do over the years, and have urged many younger men to do, the danger of neglect of family. And I can remember back to my own family and my father being a pastor. I've heard my mother, as I said before, say to my father, "You have time for everybody but us." And I've heard my own wife say that to me, the difficulties of the pastor's wife and the necessity of guarding your family life. When Judy and I were thinking about marriage and we became engaged, I said to her, "Now, do you realize what you're getting into?" And she was very starry-eyed at that point and said, "Oh, I just look forward to, you know, our partnership as being a pastor and his wife." And after we were married, it wasn't very long, maybe 6 months, before she began to say, "Why didn't you warn me of what we were getting into?" Yeah. And then later on, I heard my wife say many times, "Isn't there anything else you could do?" And I don't know if you've heard your wife say that yet or not, but I think probably most pastors have had their wives say to them, "Isn't there anything else?" And I'd have to say, No, there's nothing else I could do. You know, Charles Spurgeon said, if you can do anything else, do it. And people were thinking, well, if you don't have any other skills, you better just stay with the path. But what he was saying was, if you could be satisfied doing anything but this work, do it. There was a time in Jackson when I became so discouraged that I actually got in my car and drove to Atlanta and looked for a job. Mm. And I talked with a pastor there that you know his history, and he was running for Congress there, and he said, well, you know, when I get elected to Congress, then you can take this church. And I said, what size shoes do you wear? And he said, well, he looked down and he said, size 13. I said, well, there you have it. You know, there's no way I could take this pastor and fill your shoes. But thankfully, when I got the want ads out and went through them and looked for a job and actually went around and interviewed with people, and it was the most humiliating experience, one of the most humiliating experiences of my life. And I realized that I had no skills, I had nothing else to do, and I had known nothing else. And so God graciously put me back in the ministry, and that I had to be satisfied with it, and I had to change a lot of things. And so, you know, guarding your marriage and family life, and also along with that, the danger of immorality and the temptations that are there in the pastorate when other women are, other than your wife, are looking to you as they're feeding them spiritually from the pulpit, and maybe counseling with them and their sorry husband, you know, and they see you as just some ideal man. And I've told several of the younger men, if you touch that woman, your ministry is gone. Mm. And I think that's a very crucial thing, to guard your heart, guard your marriage, and then guard your personal walk with God. So that, I'd put all that under piety, true piety. And as you say, there's a balance between, on the one hand, the danger of pietism, and on the other hand, the danger of antinomianism, or just the licentiousness, or, you know, there's the extreme of true, the real thing is true biblical piety.
Right.
And we need to start there. That's where I would start.
Right. No, wonderful. What about, what next? What would you encourage a young pastor who feels like he is growing in Christ-likeness, and in love with Jesus, in love with his word, and what other lessons would you instruct him to contemplate in the beginning of his ministry?
Well, I would, if you move from pies to docs, which means doctrinal soundness.
I see the pattern there.
You know, I would say keep the faith. And I would, when I say keep the faith, I mean the historic Reformed faith, from not only the ecumenical creeds of the early church and the Reformed creeds, to see these as a kind of paradigm, that we stay within those, that framework, the Apostles' Creed, the Nicene Creed, and we would say all the Reformed confessions and creeds. We don't agree on every issue, but those are a good general, you know, guidelines for us to stay within. But keep a balance between keeping the faith on the one hand and making doctrinal progress on the other hand. We've got to stay the course, and yet we've got to grow. And the Puritans used to say, God has yet more light to break forth from his word, more light to break forth, but it's from the word of God that the Holy Spirit will lead the church. And so we make doctrinal progress, and we have the formula which says reformed and continuing to reform according to the word of God. Now, my professors in seminary, most of whom were neo-Orthodox, when they talked about the Reformed faith, they were saying, be willing to change, you know, and they were almost encouraging us to follow every wind of doctrine. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, there are those who are we are Reformed, and we want to stay Reformed, and we want to entertain any other thoughts about any changes we might make or growth. Now, people have complimented me over the years as someone who is open to change when he can be shown that that change comes from the Scriptures. And I hope that that's true.
Let me interrupt you right there. One of those changes, you mentioned this recent, was a pretty big one. And it was essentially forsaking, for biblical reasons, you believe to be very clearly stating the scriptures that Christmas was an ungodly holiday that ought not to be observed, and you, which I think is a very crucial element in pastoral ministry, had the humility to listen, to contemplate, and that cost you a bit, didn't it?
It did. It did. If I've ever been persecuted for anything, I would say I've been persecuted more for my anti-Christian Christmas views than any other issue. Yeah. So I was persecuted not for righteousness' sake, but for a mistake I made, and I greatly regret that. And it was very difficult for my family. I don't know if the story is worthwhile, but there was one time in my ministry here. I actually have had people over the years leave the church, and some of them left immediately when there was no Christmas sermon on the Sunday before Christmas, walked out of the church and never returned. And I've had people, and in Jackson, I had anonymous letters written. If you don't believe that Jesus was born, why are you in the ministry? Why don't you move and leave us alone? You know, that had that kind of opposition. And I've come to realize that I neglected my family in something that's very important, and the observance of the Incarnation.
I think it's important to know. I think this is a great lesson for me and anyone listening to this episode here. That it takes a certain kind of pastoral humility. I think a lot of us in the pastorate who are seminary trained develop a sense of conviction about certain ideas. And we pour our hearts into them, and because we believe they're biblical, and when we're confronted by it, it probably means that if we change, it will change the trajectory of our ministry. And that takes an incredible amount of humility to submit to the Word of God in that way, and submit to wise counsel, even though you have been in ministry for some time. But always realizing that you're under the authority of the Bible. Right? Even if it means changing a gigantic portion of your conviction.
Well said. Better said than I can say.
No, I think it's a very important point.
That change came about, at one point when our friend Jeff Myers confronted me, or Jim Jordan has confronted me over the years about it. We have discussed it. And Eric Storr here in this church, we've discussed it for many years. But when I was... When I came to the point of changing my views and thinking, I was preaching through Esther, and came to Feast of Purim, and all the continuing feasts there and the observance there, and so when I made that announcement, when Jeff Myers confronted me, and he was going to write an article against my article, and he called me and said, as a friend, I want to let you know that I'm thinking about this. And I said, well, I have changed my views on a lot of areas, and I have to go back and read that again and see, if I'm still there. And when I went back and read my article, which is widely circulated, I mean, they were ordering it from Scotland. I had, people order that booklet of mine, and it became kind of a standard anti-Christmas tract. When I went back and read it, I thought to myself, I'm doomed. And so I called, and my wife Judy was with one of our children in Birmingham. She was having her baby, and Judy was not there. So I called Judy, and I said, I've got something to tell you about. She said, oh, no. What now? And I told her, I said, I had had to reconsider my views. And before she even came back home, she was visiting the after Christmas sales and getting decorations and the rest. But when I preached that sermon from Esther, they were almost literally dancing in the aisles at the church, and they were. And I asked them to forgive me for my views, and what I feared then was people were going to say, if you were so wrong about this, what else are you wrong about, and how can I trust with you? And but that was the issue that people had with me when I held those anti-Christmas views. They would say, if you're so wrong about this, How can I trust anything you say? And now you've changed your mind on this. How can I trust anything you say? But there were a lot of, and so I asked the congregation to forgive me. And after the service, they were lined up to forgive me. So, Pastor, we forgive you. They were so glad that we were going to return to a Christmas observance. And I had really become, if I had been known for anything else, I was known as the Grinch that stole Christmas. But you know, people were gracious with me in Jackson on that issue, though people did leave the church over it, and they did trust that I did want to believe whatever Scripture believed, and I was willing to stand against something that I thought was wrong and misleading. And I realize now that, you know, that I was reacting to the commercialization of Christmas, which I still am still very concerned about, the way that the Christmas observance in America has been so distorted and perverted. And but the incarnation is if I had to summarize the gospel in one word, I would say incarnation is what. And I have told even members of in my wider family that who are not Christians that you know, that's what they've got to deal with. Who is Jesus? Who is Jesus Christ? Yeah, I have been willing to change, but I think what I would say to younger men is be very careful about changing, and be slow and deliberate in making doctrinal shifts. Seek counsel. Work within a group. I think, you know, the reformers, particularly Luther, was careful about that. He was not out there on a limb on his own. He was working with a group of men, and preferably in an ecclesiastical context, you know, as we have a presbytery and larger presbytery, and seek counsel, work within a group. And, you know, most of our ministers have gone through various stages of fundamentalism, dispensationalism, antinomianism, charismatic movement, all of these different areas. You know, in my ministry, I've been basically historically Southern Presbyterian, and even though my growing up was a very nominal Southern Presbyterianism, and I didn't agree with my dad on many things, I have had to come to a position that is strongly Reformed, but I want to be Reformed and continuing to reform according to the Word of God. I think particularly we use Acts 17:11. The people in Berea were more were better than those in Thessalonica, right? Berea and Thessalonica, because they daily searched the Scriptures to see, they received the Word with eagerness and daily searched the Scriptures to see if these things were so. And I think we tend to think of that. I've heard evangelists say in the past, don't believe anything until you see it in your own Bible, with your own Bible in your own words. And to me, that's not the way we should change. I think it was within the church that they were searching the Scriptures. They were, first of all, receiving the Word with eagerness. That's the key. Receive the Word with eagerness and daily search the Scriptures within the body of Christ and under the leadership and the authority of the authorities in the church. That's the way we're to grow and to change. So we do that together.
Well, that's wonderful. Yeah, they weren't ecclesiastical anarchists in isolation thinking through the Bible alone. It was always in that context of the community of Christ.
Yeah,
I think that's a wonderful lesson for pastors, I think, who also have a tendency to be very isolated in their studies. I think it's important, even after seminary training, to continue a certain level of camaraderie and friendship with other ministers and thinking through issues and topics and sermons. Well, we have a short time left here. Can you maybe offer a couple lessons, and then I have a few closing questions for you, Mickey. But I want to make sure you offer some thoughts about pastoral ministry, especially for those who are beginning their work.
Well, I would say, go back to this whole question of preacher or pastor, you know.
Right.
And I sat in on an examination of a minister recently, and one of the interim pastors that I had, and I asked him, do you want to be a scholar or a shepherd? And I was waiting for the answer to be yes. You know, I want to be a scholar and a shepherd. Now, he did finally get around to that answer, but he started out saying, well, I'm more interested in being a shepherd than a scholar. And though I think scholarship is very important, he did say that. So I would say that there are many different styles of preaching. My preference is greatly for continuous expository preaching. There are many styles of preaching, and there are many styles of pastoral experience, many different personalities and gifts of pastors.
Right, right.
Another article that has greatly influenced me was called The Excellence of Plodding by Maurice Roberts. And this is back in December of 1983 in the Banner of Truth.
Yeah, right.
And so the excellence of plot, I've always considered myself a plotter. I am a plotter, and not a P-L-O-T-T-E-R, but a plotter with a D. And there are some pastors that have, you know the languages, know the original languages, and a great preacher, dynamic preachers, and known as great counselors and all of this. And none of us have all those gifts, but some of us, I would consider myself a two-talent man and not a five-talent man. And some pastors have more gifts for administration than others, and some have more gifts for preaching, some have more gifts for pastoring. But to see the balance and the need for all of those, and to see that your leadership is a shared leadership, whatever view of the number of offices you have in the church, to see it's not a one-man show, it's not all about me, it's not all about my kingdom, or building my kingdom, it's building the kingdom of God with the people of God and the priesthood of all believers, but especially the parity of the elders, the responsibility that they have to be a man under authority yourself, and to, when you change or when you preach or teach, to avoid the extremes of authoritarianism on the one hand and egalitarianism on the other hand, to have that loving leadership that we should have for our wives, that same loving leadership for the congregation.
Let me ask a question that is generally not asked of pastors. I think a lot of people are interested, what do you say to young pastors coming to ministry? But I don't think I've ever heard anybody ask a pastor, what do you do when you, quote unquote, retire?
Mm-hmm.
What should be the function of a minister when he retires? What is your answer to that question? Because I think, I came into ministry as you were there in my ordination. Preach for me, have a very instrumental role in my life. I came at 29, mm-hmm. and now I'm 39.
Mm-hmm.
And for the first time in my life, I'm already beginning to think, okay, I only have a couple decades left here before the church is in need of, a fresher face. What do you do at this stage of life?
Yeah, very good. Very good question. I've asked myself that question a whole lot, even recently. In old age is such a time of reflection, that's one of the reasons I'm writing some memoirs now, is to evaluate the past and how I advise people for the future. There would be a good argument against retiring at all. Mm-hmm. Many people would say you should never retire, and I know pastors that are going to go on until they die, and have one friend, a close friend right now who's just say, I'm not able financially to retire, and I don't believe in retirement, so I'm going to go on. But I think, the danger there is I'm going to go on until the congregation dies, dies with me. And so the way I went about it was to announce to the congregation, I think if I already mentioned this, when I was 60, I said I'm going to retire when I'm 70. And then not so much for myself, but for the congregation. The time will come when we need the leadership for the next 25 years, and this 25 years is over, 26 years, so the church now needs to move on to the next 25 years. And it's not easy for me financially, and we've had some struggle, but we God has blessed us greatly, and we are doing very well, and our marriage is the very best it has ever been, because we have time for each other, and we do everything together. And so the first thing I did, the way that we transferred from my pastorate to Ben's was that he became my assistant for 6 months. Mm-hmm. And then we turned around and I became his assistant for 6 months. And then I took these interim pastors. So I left him to be the pastor. And in my life, I tried to be in a low profile, has been my thing in the church, to stay as much as I can in the background and let, if anybody wants advice, to come to me for advice. But if they come to me for counseling or come to me for marriage or a funeral or whatever it is, I would say, you notice that I have not worn clerical collar, and I don't wear it to church anymore, because I want the one guy to be wearing the clerical collar, and that's your pastor over there. Right. And so if somebody wants me to perform their wedding, I would say, oh, well, there's your, and this, I learned that from my dad, because my dad did that, and it worked very well in retirement. Now, he actually was hired by the church to be the minister of visitation. So he was the organizer of the visitation in the congregation. And then he became, then the hospital actually hired him to be a chaplain of the local hospital. So he never retired. And then he went into a congregate living facility after my mother died, and he started having Bible studies and ministering to people in the congregate living home. And he told me, he said, the only problem I have here is there's so many old people around. He was probably the oldest. Trent Lott's mother was there in the same nursing home or congregate living home with my dad. To me, continuing some ministry, which I have now in the prayer breakfast,
right.
And that to me is very satisfying, because that's been kind of my, in a lot of ways, my lifeblood. Organizing the prayer and having praying with the men, and we're still doing this after 35 years.
And you continue. I'll add this, because I'm aware of it. You also continue to be a source of wisdom, not only to the congregation wherever you are, but to other pastors. And I think that's a continual idea of being a pastor to other pastors. I think it puts you in a very unique position.
Yeah, it does.
I think a lot of pastors in their younger years need to contemplate the fact that their ministry is a preparation so that one day they can minister to other pastors in that same position.
Yeah, I think we can never retire with the idea of I'll just, play golf and play. I talked with a military man not too long ago who's living in a, he's very wealthy now, and he's living in the where he goes to, bridge one night and plays golf every day and tour tennis and does not have any responsibilities at all. And I think that's that's not a good thing. We look at Moses, how he, was 85, and of course he was still, his vigor was unabated, and that's not true of me at all. Mm-hmm. But he lived on to 120 maybe, right. And was still very active. And so I think we should stay active. Greg Strawbridge has been a good example to me in that, to say, stay active. And he is very active. I had planned to do much reading and writing, and I hope to do some more of that. And, I don't think that my memoirs will be published, but they're basically for my children, grandchildren, and for younger pastors and who might be helped by it. And maybe these prayers, and I'm revising all these prayers from every chapter of the Bible, and I hope that that will be a contribution maybe to make. So,
I hope to see some of the fruit of that. I've already experienced the fruit of a lot of your pastoral labors over the years, Mickey, and you've been I know for a fact, the true joy, not only to my life, to my family, but to so many pastors, not only the CREC, but, spread around the Reformed evangelical community. So, brother, thank you for taking the time to share a little bit about your life. And this was very little about your life, but a healthy introduction, I think, for anyone curious about what the life of pastoral faithfulness looks like in the long term, right? This is a pastoral ministry. It never truly ends. And I hope you continue to pastor many pastors in the many years of God's good pastor.
Thank you. Well, still pray for me, and I enjoy very much talking with you.